It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This past weekend marked the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March. We've assembled an audio montage of people who took part in the 50th anniversary observance of Bloody Sunday this past weekend.
We are overcrowded, but that's all good, too. The fact that nobody's starting into trouble, we're having good peace and love for each other, I think it's all wonderful. It's good to have this many people in Selma.
We did not come to the top of the bridge yesterday and cross the bridge today to have anyone turn us around. We've not come this far. We've not come this far to turn around and to go back. We are at a moment when our Voting Rights Act is being imperiled.
I thank God for the generations before. I thank God for the strength that He put in them. And we have a long way to go. We're not where we want to be, but we're not where we used to be. And so together we march, together we stand, together we fight until everyone can have the same freedoms.
50 years from Bloody Sunday, our march is not yet finished, but we're getting closer. 209 years after this nation's founding, our union is not yet perfect, but we are getting closer.
We were beaten, tear gassed. Some of us was left bloody right here on this bridge. 17 of us were hospitalized that day.
And you just heard a montage of voices from this weekend's events to mark the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March. They were, in order, Selma Mayor George Evans, NAACP President Cornell Brooks, recording artist Kelly Price, President Barack Obama, and Georgia Congressman John Lewis. I'm joined now in Studio A by two Pittsburgh women who took part in yesterday's march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Jen Saffron is a writer and photographer, as well as director of communications for the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council. Jen Saffron, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here.
And also with us is Monica Swiner, who is a social worker who also took part in this weekend's events. Monica Swiner, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can join our conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. If you happen to observe the events this weekend, perhaps like many of us, you were watching on television. Perhaps like Jen and Monica, you made it down to Selma. If you did, we'd like to hear from you. If you are calling or listening from a place where that may not be Pittsburgh, but you're still someone that made it down to Selma, we would like to hear your perspective on this. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. How far have we come? How far do we need to go with the movement, the battle, the fight for civil rights, and also voting rights in America? Many feel that the ID laws that have been imposed in some areas of the country are infringing on those voting rights. What do we need to do? What needs to be done to maintain the voting rights that others fought so hard for 50 years ago? 412-246-2002, the number to call. And Jen and Monica, tell us how you ended up being invited to take part in the 50th anniversary of the March from Selma to Montgomery.
Well, Paul, Monica and I had the privilege of going to Selma, also Montgomery and Birmingham, in 2008 with my students from Pitt. We were going there as introduction to video students. It was our class. And
this was a class you were teaching at Pitt?
Yep. It was a class that I conceived and taught through Amazaji, which is a global service learning organization. And the students and I and Monica went to Alabama with the hopes to really investigate and consider race relations in this country today, to take a look at ourselves in the matter of that, and then also through video to actually take oral histories of people who were in the voting rights movement, people who were in the civil rights movement, both in Montgomery and Selma.
Probably a good idea to have done that too 7 years ago, because a lot of the people are still left today, but some are not. Monica.
Well, and that's really what it was about. And Jen had asked me to go along on the trip to be a facilitator, kind of help strategize things and also kind of help bring it home to the students. You know, predominantly most of the group were Caucasian students. I mean, so this was very foreign to them. They had no idea about it because this is a history that's not taught. And we were so lucky to be able to interview Amelia Boynton, Annie Cooper back at that time.
When you say it's a history that's not taught, is you would think, I mean, this is so much a part of the history of the United States that it would be taught. Are you saying that it's not being taught at all, or that the lessons really aren't that extensive?
I definitely don't think the lessons are that extensive from the perspective that we can memorize facts and figures, we can read history books, we can talk about these topics as sort of facts and figures and empirical data, but the work of interpreting that history on a personal level to take a look at ourselves in the matter of our own personal work that needs to be done regarding racism in this country is not something that's necessarily done. I do have to give some cred to some of the educational programs that are happening today in this city. Most notably, my son is in the Environmental Charter School, and they're doing an enormous amount of work looking at race relations. Certainly, the Carnegie Museum of Natural History's race exhibition cannot be overstated as an important moment for the public to investigate that. The interactivity of that educational display is amazing. But overall, the fact that Monica and I could take Gary Wingfield Jr. to the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery, Gary Wingfield Jr. is African-American, and his parents really wanted to essentially save him by moving out to the suburbs and protecting him as a young black man. Gary Wingfield Jr. broke down crying on the trip because he couldn't believe how little he knew about his own people's history.
How old was this individual?
I think Gary was 20 at the time.
The youngest kid we had was 20.
Well, it's interesting because we did a story on 90.5 WESA about the Pittsburgh Public Schools taking kids to see the movie Selma, and that movie, by the way, is playing still at the Waterworks, and it'll be playing at least through the end of the month to allow as many students as possible and others to get to see the film. And one of our reporters, Erica Barris, interviewed some of the students that went to see the film, and it was really interesting to hear the comments, things that they didn't realize, such as the police not caring about the harm they inflicted on people. One young man reflected that he was not aware that there were white people involved to some extent in the struggle. So what are some of the things that in the course of your work that you've discovered that are surprising to you about what people don't know about this particular event? And it was really three marches that took place over the course of a couple of weeks in March of 1965, mm-hmm. but starting with the Bloody Sunday event, which is the one in which the protesters, the marchers, nonviolent protesters were beaten savagely by the police.
I think that mostly people don't understand how important women were in the movement, how they were so relevant in orchestrating the campaigns and just lining up all the kids and the workers. I also think that they don't understand that the reason that the children were the ones mostly walking is because it was so detrimental to the parents that they would lose their jobs and they wouldn't have a way to support. You know, we interviewed people who talked about being 14 years old and skipping school and going to be on that march and running afterwards and thinking it was sweat and it was the blood running down their head from being beaten. The reality of the violence and the fact that so many adults don't know this history, so many African Americans don't know this history, that this is just an awesome opportunity to bring all of this to the forefront and really talk about where the movement needs to be now and where we're headed with it.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with Jen Saffron and Monica Swiner, who were a part of the events this past weekend in Selma, Alabama, the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March. And they are both Pittsburghers who made it down to Alabama. They wanted to be there and were there taking part in these events in person, and also the march over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. From your personal perspective, what was that like, ladies?
Well, Jen. I think there are quite a number of things to say about that many people descending upon a small rural community in, you know, rural Alabama. I mean, Selma is a small town, and, you know, here you have 100,000 people that are coming. The president of the United States is coming.
How big is the population of Selma today?
You know,
I'm not exactly sure.
I'm not exactly sure, but I will tell you it's a place that is riddled with poverty. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges for me being there was thinking about how important Selma is as a geographic location to us because of the history, but also recognizing that maybe we need to take a look at what we might do for Selma. Selma did a lot for us, but what are we doing to address rural poverty in Alabama right now? I think that it was truly a privilege to be among specifically our women foot soldier friends like Loretta Wimberly, who, you know, Loretta's 82 years old, and she called us up on the phone and said, "Are you coming down? This is a really important anniversary, Jen. You and Monica should come down." And we brought our friend Jessica and went down. And it's really that kind of personal invitation that makes it so special to us to be able to share in that commemoration and historical moment with people who were foot soldiers in the movement and just people who almost died for this movement.
How many people did you say took part?
Over this weekend, there was an estimated 100,000 people.
Okay, the population of Selma as of 2013 is 19,912, so yeah. Five times the population.
I was going to say probably 13 grand, so that's
I was thinking about 20,000. What I felt was an emotional, personal connection to it, as well as being able to see my heroes in person talking about it. I think one of the greatest moments for me was when John Lewis stood up and was talking about, as a 25-year-old kid, what he started to do, and then turned around and said that he couldn't believe he was introducing the first African-American president of the United States. You know, that was so surreal for me. It was so emotional. And, you know, I saw a lot of people in the crowd tear up about it.
And really amazing to hear so many of the individuals who were an integral part of the voting rights movement, of the civil rights movement in the 60s, saying that Andrew Young, for example, in an interview on CNN, saying that he never thought, you know, he wasn't thinking about someday becoming the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations or becoming the mayor of Atlanta. That it was about what they could create for future generations. That when John Lewis says I never expected in my lifetime to be, if you'd have told me that I would be introducing an African-American president, I'd have said you were crazy. And yet that reality has happened. They were thinking about this more in terms of a self-sacrifice, that they were not going to benefit from this, mm-hmm. that future generations were the ones who would benefit.
And I think that that's still the case. I mean, Amelia Boynton Robinson, case in point, the woman is 103 years old. And to just put that into perspective, she began working on voting rights in the 1930s. We were in her home in Tuskegee in 2008. We interviewed her for 3 hours. And the incredible amount of detail that she's able to provide about the historical events that took place, her experience at the Dallas County Voters League, you know, Amelia being honored this weekend was certainly an important moment for us, knowing her incredible contributions to the movement, and also the fact that, let's be frank, most of the people that are lauded in this movement, the icons of the movement are men. And for us, I think, a real emotional moment, at least for me and Monica and also Jessica, was really being able to honor the women in the movement. You know, the National Voting Rights Institute, they had a moment where they honored women. The Flame Dinner honored women. And I think that history is important to keep, to preserve, and to promote.
And it wasn't just the men who were being beaten. It was the women as well. These police, state troopers, and local police in Selma, Alabama, not that it's right to beat anyone, but most law enforcement officials might be a little more reluctant to hit a woman. These individuals were not.
They hit women. They hit children. You know, there were 12, 13, 14-year-old children, and they had no problem doing that. Spider Martin, of course, has the best photos of that day. And the photo of Amelia is, you know, been seen the world round. And yet you saw the devastation, you know, the blood that was on that bridge. You know, we've walked that bridge a few times. It's not that big. There's nowhere to go, you know, so you had to just turn around and run. And it was, I can't imagine. And just having interviewed people who were able to recount in such detail that they had to stop using ambulances. They were using hearse to take people off of the bridge. And the one lady told us that she saw her sister laying in the back of the hearse. She thought she was dead. Luckily, she wasn't. But the fear and not knowing what was going to happen and when it was going to stop. If they retreated, how far would they follow them?
Monica, what were some of the takeaways for you as a social worker, as a resident of Pittsburgh, being down in Selma this past weekend?
The takeaways for me were that there's so much still left to do and that we need to recommit to education and the war on poverty. I mean, when I asked Fred Gray, you know, where he thought the movement was 8 years ago, those were the two places that he told me. And what I've recognized and having raised children in this town is that they walk through the same door of the building, but they are separated and they're not getting the same education in that same building. And until we make a priority to give these children the proper education, then we're doing a disservice to the movement, to ourselves, and to our community.
And Jen, with the work that you do for the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council, are there lessons you would bring to your organization and the Pittsburgh arts world from this?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council has a strong commitment to racial equity. Work being led by Tiffany Wilhelm and Anu Jain really is about the establishment of a racial equity coalition in the arts. We take that seriously. Everyone is welcome to join that. It's about building coalition for addressing racial inequities in the arts, which are real. One of the biggest lessons of this weekend really is looking at structural, endemic racism in this country. And when we look at it through the arts, we can see very clearly that there's a strong inequity regarding funding. When you look at 7.8% of philanthropic dollars going to organizations that serve people of color, that is not equitable. How can we address that? We can address that by working together through self-examination, by putting out reports, by making requests, by policy. Certainly research and policy is a very important component of the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council to support these efforts.
We're talking with two Pittsburgh women who took part in the events over the weekend commemorating the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday and the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge by peaceful demonstrators who were campaigning for voting rights, the opportunity to register to vote, which they were being denied in Alabama. How far we've come, but how far have we to go? We'll continue our discussion with Jen Saffron, writer and photographer, as well as Director of Communications for the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council, and Monica Swiner, a social worker from Pittsburgh. They were both in Alabama over the weekend taking part in the events there. We'd like to have you join the conversation at 412-246-2002. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are looking back at a very historic weekend in Selma, Alabama, in which the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March was observed. A number of dignitaries on hand, including the President of the United States, who delivered maybe the best speech of his presidency. We're talking about this and the future of race relations, how the past impacts the present and future as we mark these anniversaries of the historic years of 1964 and now 1965 with our guests, Jen Safran, who is a writer and photographer and director of communications for the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council, and Monica Swiner, a social worker from Pittsburgh. They were both in Selma, Alabama over the weekend. We were talking during the break about, you know, there's all sorts of tensions. There are the tensions between generations. There are the tensions between the minority community in Pittsburgh and law enforcement. There are the tensions that exist between blacks and whites in this city. There's also some residual tension that probably doesn't get talked about enough. You know, there certainly has been, I mean, what was it, 100 years after the end of the Civil War and people were being beaten in the streets of Alabama. There's also this residual tension, I think, left over from the Civil War between Southerners and Northerners. And you both, as we were talking in the break, said you experienced some of that. Monica Swiner, why don't you start and maybe share some of what you experienced?
Well, there were several incidences when we went back in 2008, and having been the facilitator to help organize where we were going to eat, where we were staying, those kinds of things, the logistics of it, there were times where I was trying to save money for the group so we would eat cheaper or not. And when we got down there, on our way in Auburn, we stopped. I saw cheap tacos, thought us and the kids could eat cheap. Jen and I started walking in together, and immediately we were told we were not welcome. And that
really told you were not welcome.
It was amazing.
What did they say?
Monica and I walked in, and before we could even get 2 feet in the door, a man literally walked up to us in a confrontational manner and said, "I'm sorry, we're not serving any food any longer." And we looked at him and said, "Well, what are all these
people
eating here for?" And waiters are obviously bringing food, and it was dinner hour. It was not late at night. We're talking supper hour. And he just said, "I'm sorry, we're not serving any food." And we had to leave, basically. And there were moments even before. It was just unbelievable.
It was so crazy.
We couldn't believe it. We were in denial about it, actually.
What
Our students
was the issue? That it was a mixed race group?
Definitely.
Yes, that was definitely part of the problem. And we were in Walmart, and people would stop and look at us because we were a mixed race group. And I asked, so of course we're there interviewing and asking questions. And when they said that usually the only time that you saw mixed race people together were if they were in the military. And I found that shocking. You know, our van was hit because somebody was looking at the group and couldn't believe it and turned into our van. I mean, and
then this is 2008, people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really bizarre.
Even more bizarre is the Alabama State Archive. First of all, there's a gigantic picture of George Wallace. And then next to that is a much smaller picture of Dr. King next to each other. And so I had already been to the Alabama State Archive, and I was a little bit tired. And I said, "Monica, why don't you lead the group to the archive, you know, and I'm going to go down the street and check out this other spot for us to do some educational learning, you know, immersion, cultural immersion." Monica goes into the state archive, and the woman leading the tour would not shake her hand. Monica offered her hand 3 times, would not acknowledge Monica as the head of the group, and Monica had to appoint our student Andrea to be able to be a cultural translator from our group to the woman leading the tour.
Which really upset the students because they were like, "What do you mean she's the co-teacher?" And yet she was not paying attention. I said, "It's more important that you see the information. It's not about me. It's about the experience. So I'll step back. I'll follow along in the group." But she wouldn't make eye contact with me. She deliberately ignored me. It was so freaky.
We might assume from what we saw, the pictures from Selma over the weekend, that everything is fine in the South. They, you know, here was this celebration. You know, dignitaries, many of the same African Americans who took part in the demonstration in the march on Bloody Sunday 50 years ago, were there again. There was security on hand, but they were there to protect the participants and the audience. As opposed to what happened on Bloody Sunday. Of course, a couple weeks later on that third march attempt, federal troops were brought in and did in fact enforce the people's right to peacefully assemble and protest. But what you're painting is a different picture from what we might have assumed from what we saw on television, that everybody's getting along and everything is just fine.
Well, first of all, the commemoration is a big street festival, so it is fun. I mean, you've got street food, you've got blues music, you know, people are celebrating. It is a celebration. So in some ways, it's like a giant festival that you would take your family to. So it's not a hostile environment. This weekend was definitely a beautiful experience of many thousands of people coming together to commemorate. So,
but what you're saying, what I'm gathering from what you're saying, ladies, is that while racism 50 years later may not be overt, there's still an undercurrent of it Selma.
And in Selma and in Pittsburgh. You know, I live here in Pittsburgh. I've endured several racial incidents. I was a fellow at the University of Pittsburgh. I have a master's degree. You know, I've written. I'm not able to assimilate if I need to. And yet I've been pulled over by police officers and in fear of, you know, what was going to happen. You know, when I first moved to this city in the 90s, it used to be that you would roll down your window when you got pulled over and stick your hands out of it because you were concerned that they would think that you were making a move. Recently, I have been pulled over and somebody said that they thought, and my brother's a police officer, not here, but he is one, so I'm very respectful of the police. And he said, oh, I thought this car was using a drive-by. I want to check it out. Not a problem. He said, oh, I thought I saw a bullet casing. Excuse me? And he searched the car and he pulled out a pen cap. This must have been what I saw. If you're Superman, can you see through steel? I'm confused.
Where did you move here from?
Originally, I moved here from Newcastle in Shenango Township. So that's an hour outside of Pittsburgh.
But in Pittsburgh, what I'm gathering from what you're saying is it's not institutionalized segregation. Segregation is not the law, but segregation is what we have in Pittsburgh.
With the neighborhoods being resegregated, I recently have come back to the city, was living out in Whitehall. You know, this is not a racially highly mixed area. This is where Johnny Gamage, you know, was killed. You know, this is here. You know, to act like it's in Selma, it's only in the South, and that we're so self-actualized and so realized here in the North is not the truth. And I used to teach with Jessica Friedrichs, who still teaches cultural awareness at Carlisle University, and we would start the class saying, let's have the courageous conversation, because the only way that we're going to heal and understand and be able to tolerate our differences is to have the real conversation. And as long as we're denial or not recognizing that these feelings exist, then we're not going to grow as a people, as a community, as a city.
And to further that, I just think it's so important to recognize that race is not privy to geography. I mean, yes, we still have issues that are systemic, certainly to the South, the poverty rates in particular, the lack of upward mobility that the Pew Charitable Trust just unveiled. That's real. You know,
the poverty in Selma, as many people did point out over the weekend, is incredible.
Absolutely.
Heart-wrenching.
And so I think what we have to recognize is maybe a place to start isn't necessarily about going to a geographical place. Certainly we went there on purpose to commemorate something that happened on that location. But, you know, race is not bounded by that. Racism exists in our hearts and our minds, you know, with the notion that ingrained in our society is this entire perception that on some level, each and every one of us, each person, including us, has the idea that there's somebody out there that we think that we're better than.
And there's only one race, the human race. And as long as we continue to try to define it by color or by sex and make the differences, why don't we start looking at the things we all want? We all want a safe place to live. We all want something to do and get up and be able to support ourselves and feel good about.
Be productive members
right.
of society.
And that's the truth about it. Nobody wants that. So if we would stop fighting amongst ourselves on the fallacies and really start to elect people that are going to really look at human dignity and recognize that we are one race and work towards issues of that, which is why it's so important that the voters' rights laws stay intact.
And many people see the voter ID push, which and there was one in Pennsylvania under Governor Corbett, which was defeated. But they see it as a thinly veiled attempt to
roll back history.
Precisely. Thank you.
It's an infringement upon rights. I mean,
well, let's talk about the president. Not only did he bring up voter ID, and it was brought up by others, but the president in particular in his speech, of course, had to talk about Ferguson and how Ferguson in many ways is a barometer of where we are 50 years later and a measurement of how much still needs to be done. What does addressing the anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March mean for us now, mean for us in the context of events like Ferguson and what happened in New York and also in Pittsburgh, where we, you know, you mentioned Johnny Gamage and there's been the Jordan Miles incident, the Leon Ford incident since then that has left us with a palpable tension between the minority community in this city and law enforcement officials, which our new police chief, Cameron McLay, is trying diligently to work through. But what does the commemoration of events over the weekend, how does that impact the dialogue about the problems that we are currently dealing with?
Well, definitely part of the commemoration. You know, I did mention it was a street festival. That's absolutely true. But a key component to this past weekend was about teaching and about learning firsthand from people like our Shiro, Diane Nash, about what nonviolence means today, about committing to that as a practice and as a discipline. I think one of Diane Nash's key points in a panel that we were privileged to attend was that there is a distinction between protest and a movement. And the issue that we were left with thinking about is, what's the campaign? What's the movement? How can we really galvanize? I mean, does anybody really have any understanding of what it takes to get 600 people totally unified in their will, in their faith, to walk across a bridge knowing that they could definitely die? Or the Freedom Riders who signed their wills before they got on the bus. That kind of discipline and iterative work that's slow-moving. People think the civil rights happened in the 60s. That's not true. It started long before that. And so I think that one of the biggest takeaways from commemoration is listening to our heroes, listening to the inspiration that they bring to us now to commit to the movement. It's not enough to put on a Facebook post. It is not enough to show up with a sign. It is not enough to wear the T-shirt and say, I was there. It is not enough to get on a plane and go to Ferguson to participate in a protest. It's really about committing to the iterative work. There are people here in Pittsburgh who are doing that. I really, really encourage everyone who's listening to investigate issues that matter to you most. John Lewis said that in his speech. Don't give up on the things that matter, that are of great value to you. Stick with it. Stay with it. Work with it. Push and pull, as he said. This is time-consuming work, people. And I think that one of the takeaways of commemorating a movement like this is that it's actually a movement, not a protest, not a single issue, but a group of people working on a campaign in a unified way.
That it's part of the movement today. It's part of the conversation we're having today to have a commemoration like we had this weekend.
Absolutely.
I also think that it was imperative that while this is all going on, that Diane Nash chose not to walk the bridge with the president because she felt so strongly about President Bush being there. And she was so concerned about the images that would be sent out that it was then okay, that this was all better.
She was concerned about President Bush taking – she didn't feel that he should?
No, she said that he didn't stand for that, that he was not about – nonviolence, and she was very firm about it. So she's standing on the bridge about to walk with the president, and she left and did not walk.
But didn't he sign the extension of the Voting Rights Act?
He did, yeah, and also Ronald Reagan did.
Yeah, but she also felt it was hypocritical.
Well, I mean, the abridgment of the Voting Rights Act has actually happened with President Obama in the White House, right?
Yeah, and isn't that an interesting point that was brought up by several of the speakers in the workshops that was going on, you know, and that I think is right there, the irony of the whole situation. You can give lip service. You can do a really nice speech. You can put on the T-shirt and wear the pin. But where are you when it's time to do the work? And do you really mean it? And are you really willing to put it all on the line for that? I'm here with Jen, and because I know that both of us are that committed.
That's Monica Swiner. She's a social worker, and also with us, Jen Saffron, of Women from Pittsburgh, who attended the events over the weekend to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March. Still time to take a phone call or two at 412-246-2002 if you'd like to join the conversation. A question that has come up over the weekend, of course, an unfortunate incident. Another black teen shot by a white police officer in Madison, Wisconsin. Did this come up in conversations over the weekend?
You know, we were in such a bubble. We were in such a bubble that, you know, we're just now, we got back at 1 a.m. last night. We are just now starting to get the footage and that kind of thing. But what I will say about that is that from Emmett Till until now, it seems to be okay to kill black children. And, you know, until that's not palatable for people, then I think we still have a major problem.
When you spoke with our producer, Jen, before you left for Alabama, you mentioned one of the issues this event raises is, and I'm quoting you here, what can white privileged people say about this movement, end quote. Would you elaborate on that?
Sure. I think that it is crucial that people like myself, white privileged people, I'm willing to say that, are investigating what that privilege means, what that does to others, how much space we take up, how we may be inflicting microaggressions against people and we don't even know it because we're just prescribing to the dominant cultural values of our time, really looking at where we choose to interact with people, who those people are, what are we saying and doing. Do we wake up every morning and really ask that we have the capacity to speak our truth about issues that matter to us most and not just get into the routine of collecting more resources? I think these are really critical questions that often do not get asked simply because I don't think people, and you know, myself included, have the time it takes to sit and reflect. I think we need to build that into our daily life. I think we need to think about where we may use our own power to give some of that away to people who may need it. I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about this morning is structural change is not really going to happen until people are willing to share power and share resources and share space. It's not going to be that one day people just wake up and say, yeah, it's not a problem, you know, for me to give away my resources to someone who may need it. People need to do more work to look at what that actually might entail. And that's why I think that white allies are very important to the movement. I also think that it's very important for white allies to recognize that we need to listen and be mindful and pay attention to the history that is not ours, but the history that we have actually inherited.
I also think that it's important for African Americans who are privileged. I consider myself privileged on many levels. I'm educated. I come from a two-parent family. I have good jobs. You know, that those are the people that don't – we need to stop and say, okay, just because I'm doing a little better doesn't mean that we do not have the responsibility to go back and teach and show and help get our brothers and sisters and bring them forward and to educate them about the process of how you do those things. I understand that rage. Trust me, I understand it. I feel it. But reacting on it is not going to get the choices and the things that you're really looking for.
I think what a lot of people ask today is, can change be made through working through the system for example, the apathy that people have about voting, the very thing that people died for, that were beaten up over on that bridge 50 years ago, And now it's stunning, and you can see the indignity that people feel who were part of that movement, that now what they fought so hard for, people take for granted and don't even, in some cases, care about.
We have to vote, even if you feel like it's futile. The more that we get together and decide who we're going to vote for, then that's why you get involved in people's campaigns. That's why you get involved to sign up for somebody that you believe in and that you can trust. But if you throw away that vote.
One of the most.
I'm sorry, Jen. I want to jump in because we're running out of time. We have to wrap up. I just want to very quickly. The Selma to Montgomery march took place in a volatile time. Television brought it into our homes 50 years ago, the violence inflicted on civil rights demonstrators. In your opinions, can nonviolent demonstration be as effective today in the face of the shootings and the deadly suffocation of unarmed black men? And I'll start with you, Jen.
I think that nonviolence, some people might think that that's a passive approach. It's actually a very, very, very powerful resistance. I think we can go to Gandhi and recognize that an entire country had a revolution. I think certainly it is meaningful and relevant today if enough people are willing to do it together.
And Monica?
I think she's exactly right. I agree with everything she just said. I think, though, that we need to pick our battles.
Monica Swiner, social worker, taking part in the events, the 50th anniversary commemoration of the Selma to Montgomery March over the weekend, along with Jen Safran, writer and photographer, director of communications for the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council. Thank you both for a very enlightening conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, we will talk with a member of the Earthquaker Action Team about how it helped force PNC to divest itself of companies involved with mountaintop removal mining. That's next on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last week, PNC announced plans to scale back financing of companies involved with mountaintop removal mining. It's a process in which companies blast off the top of mountains to get at the coal and is both unsightly and unhealthy. The decision was due in part to pressure from the Earthquaker Action Team, which, over the past 5 years, has led a campaign to force PNC Bank to end investment in mountaintop removal. I'm joined now by phone from Philadelphia by Earthquaker Action Team Board Chairman Eileen Flanagan. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks for having us.
We invited a PNC representative to join us on the program today. They declined, but PNC did offer this statement. Our coal financing policies have changed over the past 5 years based on health and environmental concerns, as well as our own risk appetite. We see this as a way to continue serving our clients in the region while contributing to a better environment for everyone. End quote. That statement coming from PNC. Eileen Flanagan with the Earthquaker Action Team. How did you get the news that PNC was ceasing its investment in mountaintop removal?
Well, we've been monitoring them for 5 years, and so we know that early March is when they often put out their corporate responsibility report. We had a big year this year. We really increased the pressure on them, so we were looking for that report with great anticipation and read about it when it came out last Monday.
What issues did your organization have with PNC's investment in mountaintop removal? What are the health concerns with this particular method of mining coal?
Well, as you said, it's a terrible method. They blow up the tops of mountains and then dump the debris in streams. And that's been known to cause high rates of cancer, birth defects. It pollutes the water and kills the fish. There's all kinds of health problems with it. And it also contributes to climate change, both destroying the trees and the burning of the coal. So it was an issue that really affected a local community, but also globally.
And how long had you been working to get PNC to address this issue?
We've been campaigning 5 years, and part of the reason we focused on PNC is that they bragged about being a green bank. They're very proud of their green building initiatives, which is great, but if they're lending money to a practice that is so destructive, we really don't think they could call themselves a green bank. So over the 5 years, we've been pointing out that hypocrisy and challenging them to really live up to their hype.
In its report, PNC said that since late 2010, the bank's involvement in mountaintop removal financing had declined significantly. That's how they perceived it. Why was it important to you to keep the pressure on, even though this was happening? Even though PNC is saying that this is happening, we're getting out of this. We're really it's not a significant involvement anymore. But clearly the Earthquaker Action Team felt it was important to keep the pressure on. The question is why.
Well, we really didn't feel that the change they made in 2010 was good enough. We don't think it's a coincidence that they only came out with a policy on this after we started our campaign. The health concerns have been known for decades, but in 2010, they came out with a policy that sounded good, but when we read the fine print, we realized it wasn't actually going to change their investment policies very much, because companies generally don't loan for a specific project. It's not like an individual who borrows money from the bank for a mortgage for a certain house. They were still lending lots of money to companies doing mountaintop removal coal mining, even if a specific mountaintop removal project wasn't listed on the loan. So we wanted to see them sever ties with those companies that are doing the worst damage.
And are you completely satisfied now?
We're very happy about this news. We're really excited, not just for ourselves, partly for the people of Appalachia who have been struggling against this practice for decades. And we're also really excited for the wider climate change movement. There have been a lot of indications lately that small groups of people working together can really make a difference. And that's part of what we are happy to see, is more evidence of that. Our little group has a budget of $100,000 a year. We don't even have an office or a full-time staff person. And PNC netted $4.2 billion last year. So we think it's really exciting and important for people to know that a small group can make a difference even against big institutions.
Based on your knowledge of this, how does PNC plan to cease its involvement in mountaintop removal?
They're basically saying that they won't extend credit to companies that they would otherwise extend credit to, that this has now become part of their criteria for saying no to loan possibilities. And we're hoping that that means really a phasing out completely. We plan to monitor this and keep our eye on it, and if that's not what happens, we now have supporters all over the country. We're going to be ready to jump back into action to keep the pressure on if they don't really phase out.
We're talking with Earthquaker Action Team Board Chairman Eileen Flanagan. And Eileen, now that the Earthquaker Action Team can place this in the win column, what's next?
We are just starting conversations about that. We're really excited to see what kind of campaign we can take up next. There's lots of issues out there, and so one thing we'll be looking at, what do we have to bring, a place that we could make a specific difference. So we'll keep you posted when we know what that is.
Eileen Flanagan, Board Chairman of the Earthquaker Action Team, talking about PNC announcing plans to scale back financing of companies involved with mountaintop removal mining, something that the Earthquaker Action Team has been pressuring PNC to stop doing. And we did invite a representative of PNC to join this conversation. However, our invitation was declined. Eileen Flanagan, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this edition of Essential Pittsburgh. If you missed any portion of this program and would like to revisit it or past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. or listen to Essential Pittsburgh as a podcast in iTunes. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.